Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Everybody, it's Liz. Welcome to the show. I'm joining you as usual from Central Virginia on the unceded ancestral lands of the Monacan Nation. And I think I mentioned this on a prior podcast episode. Just because I said ancestral lands does not mean that the Monacan Nation is not here anymore. They are. It's a federally recognized tribe. They have headquarters just up the road from me, along with a history museum. And they're among the first indigenous people of this nation to encounter European colonizers at Jamestown, where some of my own ancestors landed in the mid-1600s. And so I bring that up to remind you, as always, that you can find out whose native lands you're residing on by checking out the world map at native-land.ca, and also to suggest why stop there. Why not try to learn a little more about who these people are, where they are now, what's important to them, if possible, in their words, not just in the words of historians of European descent. And it isn't always easy to find this info, depending on where you are. I know this to be true, but it's worth the hunt, which feels like a little foreshadowing to the conversation I'm about to have, but we'll get to that. Anyways, I will put that website in the show notes, and that's just a little food for thought for you. In the meantime, a little plug for my book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine. It's out from Womancraft Publishing. It's available wherever you might buy or order your books. It won a 2023 Gold Nautilus Award, which is super exciting to me. These are books that are awards that are given to books that promote spiritual growth and conscious living. So it's kind of a big deal for me. If you're interested in buying it, would you consider doing so by purchasing it directly from Womancraft? They are an amazing independent woman-owned business. Or order it from your local bookstore. And if you've read it and you liked it, you would bring me so much joy if you gave it a favorable review on Amazon or Goodreads. Beyond bringing me joy, which is nice, but you know, there are bigger things at play here. You are also, you're paying it forward for somebody else, because every review helps other people find this information. And especially if you're starting to learn about this, it's not always easy to find it. So your reviews do make a difference. And the same goes for this podcast. If you like it, please consider leaving it a favorable review. Reviews on Apple Podcasts, iTunes are super helpful, but I'll take them anywhere. And last thing, get in touch. I always love to hear your feedback, whatever you have to say about the show. You're welcome to send me a note via social. Instagram is always good. Email works. I'll put all that in the show notes. All right. And away we go. That's that. All right. So for today's episode, I'm so excited to have my two favorite witches returning to this show. I'm really crazy about their work in the world. I truly think they are two of the best writers out there today who are doing this work of what I think of as sacred activism. And I'll let them react to that. I don't know how they feel about that language, so we can talk about that. But to me, this is taking spiritual practice and magical tools out of the realms of just personal development and personal enrichment, and really applying them to this hard question of how are we actually going to turn this shit show of our culture around? How are we going to make sure everybody has space and that no one is left behind? Such important work. So let's get on with it. Risa Dickens and Amy Torok are the co-authors of New Moon Magic, 13 Anti-Capitalist Tools for Resistance and Reenchantment, which is coming out September of 2023. They are also the co-authors of Missing Witches, Reclaiming True Histories of Feminist Magic, both from North Atlantic Books, I think, yes, okay. And they are the co-host of the Crazy Good podcast, Missing Witches. Bust Magazine wrote that Dickens and Torok teach us what it means to create art, engage in activism, and exist at the intersection of witchcraft and feminism. Liz Kelly of Home to Her podcast says they're awesome. They're doing a whole lot of good stuff. You can find their books, podcasts, zine, and coven at missingwitches.com. Amy and Risa, yay, you're back.
Yay. It's really good to see you again, Liz.
You too. I think it's been almost 2 years now. I I feel like it was. I think you were on in the summer of 2021, I believe. So.
I do want to say from the jump that I also loved your book, and I passed my copy along to my mother-in-law, who is sort of the generation who isn't like screaming about their right to take up space. And I really think that your book and my presence in her life are really expanding her view of herself. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for passing it on and thank you for sharing that. That's awesome. I want to ask you guys, okay, so how do you feel? I said sacred activism as I was writing that. I'm like, do you guys, how do you feel about that language? How does that land for you? How do you think about your work and what you're doing? Let's just jump right in. That's a big question.
Yeah, I'll own that. Sacred activism, that's fucking rad. Thanks. It's tricky, you know, like the work of like accepting that you have put yourself in the place that you've put yourself is a strange part of being a writer and being a podcaster and building a community that like part of myself would like to just sort of dissolve sometimes into the work of the collective and to not be centered as myself as a voice, you know? And so to claim that we're sent that we're teaching people something about magic or anything really, that we're somebody to be followed for anything kind of feels counterintuitive to the way that we work. Like we went out looking to teach each other, to teach ourselves stuff, and in the process like got to teach each other stuff, got to learn. I got to learn so much from Amy in my process of like seeking out these stories, and that feels so ongoing. Like the more you discover, the more you discover how much you don't know, and that process is totally thrilling. And I do think that like because we've had to like and had the opportunity to like stop and think out loud about it in a community of people and in conversations with other thinkers who are like, how do we use these missing histories to give us strength today? Like how can these obfuscated stories strengthen our resistance, strengthen our activism, strengthen our magic so that we don't get fucking burnt out, so that we can maintain hope when the world is literally on fire and the fire is breathing down our backs today, literally where we are. How do we stay like alive in that moment? And so I think, you know, I think the books do an okay job of like sharing where we're at in uncovering those stories and in sharing the like brilliance that we've gotten to hear from so many people investigating how they use tools for magic. But yeah, it's definitely something that I like my tummy like curls in on itself when you say those words, sacred activism, that I might be a piece of that. But I do think what we do as a community is exactly fucking that.
What Yeah, about I want to add that there's something about the project that laid this foundation in very clear terms for us, and I mean that because we have been collaborating since the beginning. So we have this structure that's built on the two of us, who immediately, as soon as we met, viewed each other as equals, but also like awe-inspiring titans, at the same time, if that makes sense. And so everything that we've done has been this collaborative work, and we have to bring that collaborative spirit into everything we do because there are two of us. We have to be open to someone else's ideas. We have to be open to another way of thinking about things. And so that informs everything that we've done since we began the collaboration. Risa and I are in this together. And then the rippling out of that is that, like, Liz, you're in this with us, and our coven is in this with us, and the world is in this with us. And so that I don't get overwhelmed by that, or the imposter syndrome doesn't rise up too much. I think of the Lane Redmond quote. She wrote a book called When the Drummers Were Women, or When the Women Were Drummers. Sorry, Lane Redmond. But she reminds us that cultural transformation begins with individual transformation. So all I can really do is set myself out into the world and control my actions. I can't control the actions of anyone else. I really can't. But we've had so many people tell us that we being Risa and I, have sort of taught them a different way of operating in the world, which to me, like, we are mentors because we do take people into our circle and give them advice when they ask questions, but I prefer to think of us more as like a role model. We just go and we exist in the world in the way that feels good and right and sacred and correct to us. And then people see us doing that and go, oh, maybe I can live in the world in a way that feels correct and sacred to me. And I think it's important to note, like, Risa and I are very different people, but that doesn't mean that one of us is better than the other. And then we can take that mindset again out into the world. Just because you think differently than I do, that's an opportunity. You know, like Audre Lorde was always talking about this opportunity of difference, that it shouldn't be something that separates us, but rather that something that can help us grow and expand together.
I just want to add, we give advice always under the umbrella context of you have to promise to ignore our advice and do exactly what makes sense to you in your specific context and moment. That's the caveat I always gave to my little sisters. Love having opinions. Definitely don't want you to like copy paste my desire to have an opinion on every fucking thing into your life when you are the weaver of your life. And yeah, you know, we just feel really, really lucky to get to learn from so many people and for this to be kind of our jobs now. It's wild.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking too, as you're each answering that in really cool and different ways, that just how fraught our language can be with cultural baggage and patriarchal baggage. Like, even so, if I say sacred activist, I'll tell you what I mean by, well, I think I kind of said it in the intro, but what I mean by that is, and maybe what I have seen, or even, you know, early on when I was working with what I call the sacred feminine, is this sort of an insular spiral you can get where your focus is purely on the self. And like, how am I going to make myself better? How am I going to make myself better? And of course, you transform yourself. That does. Everybody you touch gets touched like that as well. But there's a way in which you can keep your focus completely insular and not really worry about whatever's happening outside of the self. And so I think of it as like taking whatever your spiritual practice is or whatever your magic practice is and going, hey, I this is some real stuff. I might actually be able to, in whatever way I can, have an impact on the world around me at large or in my community. And so that is what I mean by that. But I think it's interesting that the baggage of like activist or whatever, just like, you know, can land on the shoulders with like, with ego of patriarchy or something like that.
I've definitely heard a lot of people say that anything with an ist at the end, you know, I don't consider myself an activist because I don't blank enough, or I don't consider myself a feminist because I don't blank enough. Again, it's the weight of language and the weight of labels is a lot, and it makes us want to reject them, because if we call ourselves something, then we sort of set ourselves up for scrutiny. Well, are you really this? And if you just don't ever say that you're anything, then you don't have to worry about anybody questioning what you say. And before you jump in, Risa, I do want to add, like, I love this terminology that you've come up with of sacred activism, because we say all the time that the word witch or witchcraft or the craft or magic for us is the place where our spirituality intersects with our politics and a third intersection being with our creativity. So when you blend spirituality and politics and creativity, I think what you get is witchcraft.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's funny that trying to turn from that like always going inward spiral that I think you're so right, so much of this work can turn into, to like the Ouroboros, you know, like how do we turn the spiral so that yes, it goes inward, but it also goes outward, and it goes outward into our communities. And that doesn't have to be like, there are so many ways. We love to think about like hiding in plain sight. We love to think about like ways you can draw your magic, you know, your world changing magic into spaces and spheres where you translate it into a language that lets it pass and that lets it do its magic in different spaces. You know, like at Amy in the circle chapter of New Moon Magic, where we talk about different tools for magic, tools for activism, tools for resistance and re-enchantment. I think that chapter is so core to everything we think about, because you know, she does a great job of describing, like, all our circles are magic. The circle is already magic. Anywhere you have a circle of people, whether it's a craft circle or a fucking book club, or you get together to play cards, those are all spheres of influence and spheres of openness and spheres of exchange. And so they're all sites of magic. They're all sites where we are transformed by each other. The rules are loosened a little bit in how we exchange, and we can uplift and transform. And so they're all political sites, right? So every time we want to think about, like, the magic of, like, yeah, turning inward, healing, investigating, delving into my shadow, delving into, and then finding the place where that then loops back outward, loops back into my politics, loops back into what truths I will tell in public, you know, and then also loops wider out, like, witches also believe that we can affect the material world through non-material practices, right? And so, yes, we believe in literally, you know, mutual aid, community care, cook for your neighbors, bring food to a protest. Like, how are you involved? How does your body let you be involved? You know, where is your capacity allowing you to resist? But then also, you know, we also want to uplift that, like Nikki Sanchez said, like, small things take on big space in the spiritual world. So small gestures of a desire, of a hopefulness or a desire for change, or tapping into your rage and acting that out, you know, in your altar, acting that out in a binding spell on, you know, folks who are trying to take rights away from others. Acting that out is also part of how we believe in acting out our power. And so that, I think that there, that all of that maps into that. That we call it, like, a witch's physics of time and space at one point in the book, you know, the, like, that way of thinking about going inward to go all the way outward.
Yes. And Risa, I just saw you doing this with your hand. Sorry, listeners, you can't see that. But I, in my head, I was thinking limnus gate, infinity symbol, as you were saying. Yeah. That, because there's sort of like an contraction point, if you will, expansion point, and contraction, expansion, and it's ever flowing. Yeah.
Yes. I also wanted to say that, like, you know, part of the activism or the resistance to that always going inwards for me comes from, like, irritation with the smugness of the new age, you know? Like, that's why I felt so connected to Monica's show in New Age and Armageddon. It was like, I need to, people who are angry too, not just like so convinced that they're right with their lofty spiritual ideals. I was talking on a recent episode of the podcast about being so fucking annoyed at a yoga class where they were burning heavy, strong smelling scent without asking us whether that was okay. They were taking photos and videos without our consent. It just felt like, and everyone was so smug about it. Like, I'm tired of that kind of spirituality.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding me something in your book about, I think it's about dirt or something. Like, I'm just like, what you're saying, I'm wanting to throw dirt, like, all over the practice or something.
Right?
Yeah, I think, like, dirt shows up in, like, every chapter. It's, yeah, so core and fundamental to, like, who we are. I mean, as a species, as interspecies sharing this earth, and the fact that we call it dirt, we just, like, if you take a handful of soil, it's literally everything. It's everything that you could imagine that exists on this planet. There's living organisms and rotting organisms and everything, and we just, dirt. We call it dirt, but it's also, like, responsible for our ability to exist and eat and live on this planet. So for us, it's definitely a metaphor for all of the things that have been cast aside by colonialism, cast aside by white supremacy, cast aside by all of these ranking and hierarchies, where what's left at the very bottom of the ladder is actually the most important thing in the world. And we can take that and apply it to ourselves when we're feeling like dirt. We can flip that. I mean, witches love that, right? Let's subvert. I feel like dirt today. Oh yeah? Well, that means you're responsible for all life on this planet as right? we know
you're,
it.
You're holding all the things. I mean, what could be better than that, right? Oh my gosh. Well, this actually, I feel like this is a nice segue into, tell us, I want to hear you talk about this latest book. I love it so much. I really do. I mean, I think your writing is phenomenal. And I am really impressed by how, as a reader, the experience is somewhat seamless of you two going back and forth and sharing your chapters. I think that's pretty rare, to see people bring their voices together in that way. But maybe you guys can just talk a little bit about the inspiration behind this latest book.
Well, I can definitely say that there is a lineage of specifically women collaborating and working together to make some of our favorite books. We talk all the time. Evrisa already mentioned Monica Show and Barbara Moore, who, again, they worked across an ocean collaborating. Like, Risa and I have talked about this before. Can you imagine if we had to, like, send paper in a boat on the post across the sea and then wait a month to get each other's, I mean, all hail their perseverance and patience, because we do not share this.
No, we're both too fractured in our thinking. It never would have fucking happened. By the time it arrived, we would have been like, I don't remember writing it.
Yeah, I already wrote something completely different.
Yeah.
I was going to say, though, I bet in that slow process, like a lot of just the angst just works itself out, you know, like just gets carried across the ocean and then back. And you're like, what was I worried about? I don't know.
And they produced The Great Cosmic Mother, which is so foundational for us. And of course, we always bring up Witches, Midwives, and Nurses by Deirdre English and Barbara Ehrenreich, who it basically started as a pamphlet because they had something to say and they wanted to say it and they wanted to say it together. And again, I think like I said from the jump, you know, this started as a collaborative process. From the very beginning, the first script Risa took the lead on, and then, you know, we're pretty heavy-handed in each other, less so now that we have kind of we're on the train and the rhythm and we know how the track is laid out. But in the beginning, it was so ultra collaborative that I think both of our voices were always coming through. And to add to that, again, this notion of equality, you know, Risa and I aren't competing for page numbers, or, you know, when she succeeds, when Risa writes an amazing chapter, that's great for me. I'm not jealous. I'm like, amazing. This is part of my book too. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's that sense of equality and non-judgment. Like we were talking about the circle. I spent a lot of time in my life feeling like I couldn't say what I was thinking because I would be judged or mocked or shunned. And to find a place where you can be honest and held at the same time, it's so bountiful. It's so fruitful. I'm sorry, there's a mosquito. So listeners, if you pause and hear whooshy sounds, that's me trying to squat bugs.
Flailing wildly at the screen right now. It's pretty
And that's part of it, the flailing wildly, like the acceptance of the wild flailing. And, you know, Risa and I will literally be like, I'm not sure if this is the best idea or the worst idea I ever had. So I'm going to put it past you and let you tell me if this is worth pursuing or not. But you need to have a trusting and comfortable space in order to even bring up the bad idea that becomes a good idea.
Yeah, I'll just extend, I'll add an extension to that thought, which is what so much of the book is. We started a practice within our coven. It started with each other of like yelling, celebrating the word, like the words, please expand. Like if someone started to go off on a detour and was like, I'm lost, you know, those are the places we want to get lost with you. those are such interesting thoughts come out of those moments of divergence. And so we would, you know, we'd laughed about teachers writing in the margins, like, please expand. And we always say that to each other. And those expansions exist in the book. So we each take the lead on a chapter and then we write expansions into each other's chapters. On the book itself, you know, this time the framework was thinking about tools of magic. So drawing through interviews, research, stories to pull together ways of recasting or rethinking about how we do this thing, like how we think about this work and what are the materials. It's so commodified, it's so commercialized now, you know, the practice, the idea of witchcraft. And so there's always going to be people trying to sell you a kit of everything you need. And we really wanted to write something that reflected our experience, which is, you know, just our experience, but our experience of playing with the tools around us and thinking and seeing how those opened up magic in our lives and changed our lives, and seeing how we could follow that through into other people's stories. And so that was fun and challenging and complicated. Like some of them were ideas, like in the geometry chapter, it starts with me being pretty honest about the fact that I found it really hard to write that chapter, but insisted on writing it anyway, that I felt like there was something there I needed to investigate. There's a line from a Margaret Atwood novel, Surfacing, I think, where she says, there's something down there and I want it told. I think that's from Surfacing. She keeps diving down deeper and deeper into this lake. She knows there's some sort of carving or marking on the stone face.
Well, I gotta go back and read that. I haven't read that since my 20s. Yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't either. So I may have just like fully flourished around like an undergrad memory. But I think about that all the time, that like I knew there was some reason why I was drawn to geometry. I'm not into ceremonial magic. So those stories of like, you know, and I feel like a lot of that stuff ends up kind of just stealing from, you know, Jewish mysticism and not really citing its sources. And it's, so it's kind of complicated to talk about, but I felt drawn to the idea of like acknowledging the lines and extensions, the way that we can make the built world and its assumptions and its delusions visible. And so that we can start to intercede and imagine different shapes that it might take. And then I was only in writing it that I had this memory that I describe in the book of like the moment when geometry became like an art practice that was really transcendent for me. And I was a small kid, and it was only in the writing that I remembered that there was this origin for me to feel drawn to this particular way of thinking about the magic in the world. And so a lot of the book, I think what's fun about the book, and I could be really wrong, but I think what's fun about it is you do hear us thinking through our own memories, our own processes while we're drawing in these histories and interviews and stories. I think there's a balance there that really speaks to how we work in community and in coven too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking too, you know, something you said about, and you did, you know, but basically working with what you have, you know, like working with what's available to you. And I am always thinking from a historical perspective too, her historical, their historical, whatever perspective, that is that surely this is what our ancestors would have done. Like nobody's like running to the neighborhood store to get their crystal that was shipped from halfway around the world, you know, that they bought for $10 or whatever. And you worked with what you had, and not only did you work with what you had, but that's what makes the magic, at least in part, is you have relationship with it because it's where you are. Like you are there, it is there, so you're able to be in relationship with it, and then the whole process deepens.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thrust of the whole book. I mean, we talk about, and I have to shout out Jer Bear Jones, who sort of coined the term availabilism. And that comes up in the art chapter. And it also comes up in divination, of just like looking around. seeing what you have. You know, there are so many divination practices that are like watching a spider on a web. Like, you can't buy a spider and a web in a store and, you know, place it in a tree and wait. But that was what was so frustrating to us, was seeing all of these, like, how to do magic or how to be a witch that started with shopping lists. And for us, you know, whether it's an art practice or a divination practice or your notion of what magic means, it's not about what you can go out and buy at all. And this, and even though it's fun, and Risa and I both, you know, we love accoutrement and we love, you know, supporting artisans who are, you know, deftly carving pentagrams into mortar and pestle and stuff. Like, we love all that stuff, but we have to recognize that this is not how you enact magic. You know, there's a great Scott Cunningham quote that I will butcher, but basically, the stone you find in the street has as much power as, you know, the crystal mined from wherever. And we believe that. We believe that, especially today, with the crushing commodification of literally everything, like, we can't have hobbies anymore, we have to have side hustles, all of this stuff, the commodification of literally everything, we needed to speak out against that and say, no, you, the only thing required to be a witch, by my thinking, is a belief in your own power and your own agency and your ability to make a tiny rippling effect that echoes into the universe.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot. It's been a big inquiry for me, maybe all year, around the concept of enough. Like, what does it mean to be enough? What does it mean to have enough? And I see those things as very much intertwined. You know, if you know you are enough, then can that bring a lens to all the ways in which you are over-consuming, whether that is, well, anything, like natural resources, I don't know, entertainment, food. I mean, and all these things are good. You know, there's a delicate way in which you approach that question. But I do wonder if that commodification is fueled by the vast not enoughness that so many of us feel, and that I feel that patriarchal systems, you know, cultivate in myriad different ways. And so saying, I have enough, like, right here, like, I've got enough. I don't know. That's such a powerful thing to me. And it's a responsible thing. It's not just saying, gosh darn it, I'm good enough. There was like an old SNL skit like a million years ago. Do you remember that guy, Stuart Small?
Yes.
Or something? Gosh darn it, I'm good enough and people like me. But it goes, it actually transforms how we take from the world. Because I think if we don't feel enough, then we just go and like try to fill that hole. Anyways.
Yes, I just want to share, I was at the birthday party of twin seven-year-olds this weekend, and I had done, their mom told them I was a witch last time we were over, and they were like, this is a witch. And they asked me to do a spell with them last time, and I just did like a circle of protection, and one of the twins was like, I thought we would fly, and the other twin was like, I liked it. And then this time I was leaving their house, and they came running out, and they were like, can you do one more spell with us? One more spell. And they had music on. And I said, well, first of all, some songs are spells. So we had a dance party to Water Witch by Secret Sisters. And then I was leaving and they were coming with me, and I ran back to them and I was like, just remember, the only thing you really need to make a spell work is the magic that's already in you. And they so cutely were both like, yep, like, got it, you know. they were like got it. Like, two little seven-year-olds went off like, yeah,
I love it. That's adorable. Oh my gosh. Well, I wanted to present something that I got not just from this book but from your last book too, that I wanted to hear you reflect on. And I'm using the word multiplicity and your work in relation to the idea of multiplicity. And so one of the things that I've seen you do, I think in a really, and honestly, it shouldn't be courageous. I'm going to say courageous ways. It's just unusual. You don't see it that often, I think, in broader popular culture, is holding the seeming polarities of people whose stories you were uncovering, especially people from past times and past generations, with the gifts that they brought and the cultural limitations that they had, the biases and all that, and holding those things together. And I know the first time it really struck me, I think I was reading your first book, and I think this was a chapter you wrote, Amy, about, you were talking about Zee Budapest. And, you know, I'll put her name and her work in the show notes, you know, we won't, but basically she was really pioneering in the 70s around witchcraft. And she also holds some really anti-trans views that she has just stuck her flag deep in the earth, and she's holding on to it for all her worth. And so how do we hold those things, you know, in a culture that really wants the binary, really wants the either or, you're all good or you suck. And I felt like that came forward in this book as well. I think, Risa, you wrote this chapter, but there was information about Hildegard of Bingen, which, you know, again, she was, I don't know, 11th, 12th, 10th century nun, very, very pioneering for her times, did some amazing work around medicine and music. It was just incredible. And, you know, what can we expect from a woman who's deeply entrenched in the church in that particular time? And in, I believe she's in Germany, in that particular part of the world. She's probably not going to, like, if she were to materialize right here with her views, I don't know, this could be an interesting conversation. It might get kind of awkward. So, but I feel like you hold those things really beautifully. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and why you do that and how you do that.
Well, first of all, I'm not perfect. Are you?
Absolutely. What are you talking about?
Then by all means, never make a mistake. Never say anything.
if my almost 12-year-old daughter were here right now, she would say, I am perfectly imperfect. So
and
there you go.
Exactly. Exactly. And to me, especially nowadays, we're seeing this real cult of personality that sort of has abolished critical thinking. You know, if you like this, then you are this, and I'm not going to look any deeper. I think that's dangerous. I think that's very dangerous. We always say that the old saying of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, which is to say like to throw the good stuff out with the bad stuff. And I was really lucky writing about Z because I didn't know about the TERF stuff when I first met her, you know, when I first encountered her work. And it wasn't until I really got into researching her that I found all of this out. So I had already, and again, this was very personal for me. Like she shared a lot of history with my father, you know, with my yes. actual biological father. And so I had this like, auntie, this familial sense with her. And then it was like, oh, auntie said some stuff that I really don't agree with. But I already had her, the resonance of things she had written before I discovered that within me. So it was easy for me to be, I don't want to say soft on her because I really am declarative. Like this is where I draw the line of agreement. Yeah. But I think that she also was a product of her environment. I mean, her what do I say, man hating, yes, you know, that somehow like trickled into TERFdom. I mean, that was real. You know, she had a controlling father and lived under a controlling state under politicians, and she watched her friends get murdered who were trying to start a revolution. She watched them get shot down by the overarching control. And so you see, like, okay, she didn't just come up with this stuff out of nowhere, but she took it to a place that I don't think fits in the modern contemporary world. But she built half of a really amazing structure, and then she kind of messed it up with the attic. But we can take out the attic. You know, Risa is rebuilding her crumbling home as we speak. And so much of it is about that, about pulling out what's rotted, seeing what we can salvage of that, and then using it to rebuild the home that we live in now. And I think that that's the same for everyone, because we talked about this at the very beginning of the project. Like, what do we do about this? And we sort of, I think we had three ideas, and one was like, we could skip it, we could not tell this story at all. We could put a beautiful bow on it and tell the story but leave out those ugly parts, or we can tell the truth. And to come back to that circle mentality, like that's all we want to do. All we want to do is tell the truth about what we find, because anything else to us is non-magical. You know, we say all the time that like telling the truth is a very powerful spell. Tell the truth and watch the room change. Tell the truth and watch the world change. So, I mean, in contending with my own imperfections, my own self-loathing, my own idea that I might say something wrong and therefore shouldn't say anything at all, it is something I'm working against constantly. You have this fear that you're going to say the wrong thing, so you say nothing at all. And I mean, that's exactly what patriarchy and capitalism and hegemony wants. They want you to shut up because you're too afraid to speak. And sometimes you have to be willing to say the wrong thing, like exactly like what we were talking about before. Like, I have possibly a bad idea. Maybe it's a good idea, but maybe it's a bad idea. And the only way I'm going to find out is by saying it out loud to somebody that I trust. Mm-hmm. And luckily, the pen and the page is a somebody that I trust. I when I'm writing, I trust that page to be non-judgmental. And when it gets to readers, you know, I've already had my moment of intercourse with the page, and we've made this baby, and whatever anybody thinks of the baby is sort of out of my hands, much like everybody that we write about. You know, they put their work into the world to be judged, and so now we're judging it.
You're just making me think, I wanted to say this real quick, of Ernest Hemingway, my favorite quote from Ernest Hemingway, which is, all you have to do is write one true sentence, write the truest sentence that you know. Best charge for a writer I can think of.
And sometimes it takes, you know, 10 pages before you get to that one honest truth. And then you're like, oh, this is why I spilled all this ridiculous ink to get to this spot. And that's what we're all doing. We're all just like spilling our ridiculous ink. And then eventually we're like, this is why I was doing this. Especially for witches, you know, something happens, something comes up. You see two crows lighting on a branch outside your window when you go to get your glass of water, and this is why I did this. This is why I am this.
Mm-hmm. That did happen, by the way, listeners, right before, like literally 1 minute before we started this, I was looking out the window and these lovely black crows just flew in one after the other and landed on a branch. And then I came back to my computer and it said, missing witches has joined your Zoom. And I'm like, yep, I knew that. They're here.
I just wanted to add, I mean, that work of trying to find and tell the truth about people is endless and ongoing. And it's also so personal. Like, I mean, in the sense of like what you are going to be able to keep from someone is personal, you know? So it may be that like something that someone has done transgresses so violently for you that there is no part of their knowledge that you keep anymore. And that's okay. Some statues have to be fucking torn down, you know? They can't all be recontextualized. I went to an amazing museum once in Cape Town, and they had, in half of the museum, they had left the exhibits with the description plates exactly the way the racist leaders during apartheid had them. And they just recontextualized them. They just put another bigger plate next to the piece that told the true history of that piece, that explained and unpacked the racism in the accompanying plate, that put it all into a more honest history. Sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you can keep it and tell the story. And it's so personal. My kid loves these graphic novels called Witches in Brooklyn. And at one point in them, a witch tells her adopted or her granddaughter, you know, it's okay if an artist does something that makes you not able to love their work anymore. And it's okay if you still love and keep the work and reject the author because of what they do. Like, both those paths are okay. We have to be willing to hold those uncomfortable things. You know, Mists of Avalon came up in a circle recently, and I know it's so important for some people. I was never a Mists of Avalon person, but I know for so many people, it was like the first time that magical history was written from a woman's and feminist perspective. But she's a fucking child molester, and so is her husband, you know? So for me, that's just a line. I never read those books. I don't need to keep anything from them. There are other books, but I also like love and respect for that. For some people, that imaginary world and the way that it recast all of history, they're going to keep it. Same with Harry Potter. My sister has so much anxiety, and for her, those books were the whole world, and she hates turfdom and she rejects the violence of that ideology. But Harry Potter's a safe space for her, and that's okay. You know, it's complicated is all I'm saying.
I love you so much for saying that. I really do. Mists of Avalon, I'll put that in the show notes. It was one of those books that was just revelatory for me. And I shared about it in my Facebook group, and somebody just made an offhand comment, like, can't look at that book since I found out about her. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What did you find out about her? And now I'm like, I don't know what to do with the copy that I have because I can't recommend it. I don't feel like I can even pass it on to the library responsibly, and I can't open it again. So it just sits on my shelf and I can't revisit it. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about my own feelings about the word turf and the term and how I don't use it, because to me, it is a personal practice to me to not label people based on their worst traits. Like if I can, but I also have to say, as a white cisgender woman, it's a lot less charged for me perhaps than for somebody else. And so, and it's not the same. And I'm so grateful to the people in my Facebook group, the transgender people who have taken the time to educate me too, that it's not the same. Like, you know, women throwing insults at them, like, you know, men in dresses or something. We're not talking about the same thing. We're not talking about the same hardship. You know, you get called a name, it might be uncomfortable for you. Somebody else gets called a name, it's wrapped up in literally your life being safe or not. So I get that it's not the same for everybody. I don't know. I appreciate that. I appreciate that reflection very much.
I'll add this one thing. One time I sat with a circle of friends and I was recovering from like an abusive relationship with a con man. And a piece of that day, we were making men out of corn husks and we were burning slippers his grandmother had made. But a part that I don't know if I've told in the story before is that there was a version of the Bible in this house that was very much, I felt in the ways that I had opened it and read it, it kept resonating for me in ways that were about patriarchal control. So it was very heavy in the honor and obey versions, you know, and it was English. So it wouldn't have been even the property of the previous owners. They were very, very Quebecois. I don't know why it was in the house. And we sat while we were burning things and we took this book and we opened it and we would read a piece like it was something we were going to celebrate or something we were going to reject. And we would rip out a chunk of the book and fold it into paper airplanes or fold it into whatever and add it to the fire. And it was part of freeing ourselves from manipulative patriarchy, you know, from that literal con man. And then for all of us, from this weight of generations of being told what we could be, you know, and that was a circle of myself and queer men. And it was incredibly, incredibly empowering. So if you have a copy of Mists of Avalon that you're not sure what to do with, maybe it's part of a burning spell. I don't know.
It would make really good fuel for a fire. Oh, I do like that very much. Sorry, Mom. She gave me that book a long time ago. That's
love you, Mom.
No, I really, it was a great gift for me. It really was. I wanted it. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I really have to jump in here because the King James version of the Bible is probably the one, Risa, that you found in that house. And King James took a book and had it translated to fit his own way of thinking. For example, the word tyrant was removed entirely from the King James Version. You won't find that word in the King James Version because he was a tyrant and he couldn't possibly put out a book that said that being a tyrant was bad. So he was like, we'll just pull that part out. We'll just change this. But the good thing that we can take from King James, you know, that bit that we can snatch out of those jaws, is that we can translate. If King James can do it, then we can do it too. So let's take these books or these words that have hurt us and translate them and make them stop hurting us so that we can take the power back. King James just did that. He didn't have an authority of God. He wasn't Moses with the tablets, you know, etched by lightning. He was a power-hungry individual who thought, I can take this tool and I can change it to suit my whim and therefore change the world. And if King James can do it, then we can fucking do that too. We can take any book, we can take any word, and we can translate them so they don't hurt us anymore.
That actually feels like, to me, for me personally, like a responsibility. Like, it's not just an opportunity, it's a responsibility. It is an offering that I can give to my ancestors and to people who, you know, weren't able to do that. So I love that. You're also making me think of, have you guys read the book Witches and Pagans by Max DeShew? I just go back to that book over and over again. It's such an incredible resource. But I was just revisiting it the other day and coming across, you know, all these translations, were piled one on top of the other. So for example, I forget what it was. It was like something about praying to the Lord, which actually in the original Old English translation was, may the runes speak to me. It was about, it's about magic, and it just got changed. So there's that piece too, right? There's so many different ways in which we can go about reclaiming, whether that's, setting the book on fire or trying to find the original translation. Or, you know, Amy, I always think about our first podcast, and I ended up putting this in my book. You know, I said, this language, the sacred feminine, I don't know what to do with it. And you're like, well, come up with something new. And I was like, oh, maybe I will. I haven't yet, but maybe I will. You know, we can also come up with new language too, right? Because it's all just shit we made up. We get to make new stuff up.
And so much of witchcraft is that play with language. You know, language is like what humans have created to help us communicate past like the great hum of the universe, you know, cosmic microwave space stuff, the great hum of the universe that predates us all. This is what we've come up with. So language is a human invention. I mean, there are definitely other kin who have their own ways of communicating. I'm not discounting bird tweets as communicative or any of those things. They have languages too. We all have language.
And
Reese is so excited to say it.
Reese has got her hand up. I just want to add, and we learned, we think we learned from those kin how to formulate language, right? Like that we learned melody and different shapes of sound from bird song, that we think it was early encounters with mushroom and fungi that allowed us to form metaphorical thinking or image thinking. So yeah, just shout out to the kinship. That's all. I got excited.
Yeah. But I just want to maybe wrap this up in a bow, this part, by saying, like, to me, one of the most exciting and mind-boggling versions of the magic of language is the existence of sarcasm. Like, we can literally say the exact opposite of what we mean and have that convey exactly what we mean. And that to me is so magical. It's so like that, you know, witches, we say we live on both sides of the coin at all times. We're not either ors, we're and, yes, and, yes, and. We're improvising our way through life. Yes, and, yes, and, yes, and. And to me, again, like, I'm going to say it again. You can say the words that mean the exact opposite of your intention and have that come through to the person to whom you're speaking. Language is for play. We are allowed to do whatever we want with it. We have seen, like, Risa and I both have lit degrees. We spent hours and weeks and months and years looking at how different people use different words to convey different things in different ways, even using the same word with opposite effect. And that to me is so exciting. Like, language is yours. Language is yours. You do what you want with it. You reclaim words. Like, we were talking recently about, we were both called freak a lot in high school. And this was one of my first reclaimings. Yeah, I'm a freak. Yes, that's a compliment. Thank you for the beautiful compliment, mean football player. Like, we can recontextualize the thing, the words that people use against us, the words that we're using. Again, we can reframe. I no longer say pro-life ever. I only say anti-choice when I'm talking about this, because I don't want my brain or the people that I'm speaking to be tricked into thinking that pro-life is pro-life.
Right.
It's not. It's control. It's pro-control and anti-choice. So again, there are little things that you can do to change your words, change your brain, change your life, change the world. And language is just a tool for that play.
Mm-hmm. And of course, right, the spelling, right? That's a whole word is, we know where that comes from. Comes from magic. It's the whole idea that words have power. They have magic. They're imbued with magic. So let's spell the way we want to. I started to say appropriately. That's not what I'm trying to say. But the spell in consciously with intention. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something I thought about a lot in this book. Is like, you know, we know maybe as a starting point that like we can change the world. You know that in theory, you're taught that as a kid, like you can change, you can do anything. You could go to the moon, you could be president. But then so much of the world is so built and so structured and so keeping you moving through a series of hoops and clocks, you know, that it can be really hard to actually physically know that you have a power that is a change-making power. And so we want to like celebrate the fact and act of ritual as a way of like communicating with yourself, with your own brain and memory and energy and body, like sitting in and investing in and using tools like a knife or like a, you know, like a book, like the written word, to like focus in and guide your mind and body and heart and spirit and ancestors into coming back into an awareness that you do change the world. You can and you do change the world. And like that is a magic that I want everyone to know. I want people who feel trapped in late stage capitalism, who feel trapped in the brutality of inequality and racism and climate death in the world, to know that like this isn't a done fucking deal. You do have a world changing power. I want to know that. I want to scream it to myself.
Yes. Oh gosh, me too. Wow. Yeah, I feel like we need that really, really badly right now. And that's not to bypass all the shitty, horrifying news. It's not like you're pretending like that's not real. It's just perhaps not allowing yourself to get crushed under the weight of it.
Right. It's like Donna Haraway. We're staying in the trouble. We're mm-hmm. right here. We're going to craft right here.
Mm-hmm. I want to say or ask one more thing around this idea of... or just presence one more thing around this idea of multiplicity, yes, and something else that I love that you do in your book. I especially love that it was in the Virgo chapter because it's so Virgo, is this idea of holding science and data and logic, or just this language to me that was so revelatory when I kind of woke up to... this other language of magic and intuition and all these things that happened when I started learning about what I call the sacred feminine, that data and language, it felt like my oppressor. Like I was like, oh my God, I had no idea this was on my back so hard. Like now get off me. I want to learn this different way of being in the world. And yet I'm a geeky researcher. Like my shelves are full. I love the history shit. I cannot stop accessing this stuff. And so that's one of the things that I love that you hold to. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, this seeming polarity of like magic and data and holding those two things at the same time. And maybe even, you know, where I think it gets really interesting is when you start to bridge and you're like, oh, maybe these two things aren't so different after all.
Right. Well, that goes back to that figure eight shape, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, like I to, you know, Donna Haraway and Bruno Latour talk a lot about the sciences, not science. So we capitalize and underline science. And that sort of is a way of putting it on a pedestal again, of making it a god. But that's not really, in fact, what the sciences are. You know, the sciences are this conversation, this constant, let's have a theory, let's come together around it, let's test and see, were we right, were we wrong, let's share our results. I come from a my graduate writing was about the history of open source. I'm really interested in how people have made systems for surpassing that hierarchization of knowledge, and they built those open source systems because they remembered the commons. They remembered the common land. And so they have a shared history with witches, right? Because the common land, the taking of the common land was part of that early capitalist accumulation, as Silvia Federici says it. And it was part of what was used to demonize witches and demonize women and demonize anyone who resisted the privatization of the commons. And so we do have this shared common whole to share our sources, you know, and it doesn't mean everything should be owned by everybody. People have closed practices. There are languages and things that should be private or should be accessed with the appropriate rituals. But I do think that, like, celebrating the sciences is part of what witches have always done, that there's a relationship between those two that goes back to the beginning. You know, Diane de Prima says, we've spent all this time cutting out the magic from the history of the sciences. You know, we'll take John Dee for everything he contributed to the history of mathematics, but we'll just pretend that he wasn't deep into fucking ceremonial magic. Or, like, we'll take Newton's laws, but we don't really want to talk about how much time he spent on alchemy. And she says, you know, it's time to bring those two histories back together and see why one seeking fueled the other. What were we trying to find and what did we find along the way? And were there big, big fucking questions that have still to be asked by all of those practices? And maybe in the interplay we can get closer, you know, like, how do we save the world? Maybe we could work on that one together.
And we have to shout out White Feather Hunter and White Feather's Witches in Labs project. We interviewed White Feather and some of her lab partners in a laboratory at Concordia University about witchcraft. And the witchcraft, I'm using scare quotes for your audio audience, and the witchcraft that we create in labs. And something that White Feather said, again, going back to the play of language, and how language, you know, informs and or creates the reality that we live in. You know, White Feather said, hypotheses are prophecies. Methodology is ritual. And when you think about these words, these are synonyms, methodology and ritual. But, like, when we deconstruct, we find one on the crazy, silly, makes no sense end of the spectrum, and the other one is, like, good, solid science. But it means exactly the same thing. When we look at something as scientists, as chemists, and we say, we think that when we combine these two things, this is what's going to happen. We don't know, but we're going to try it and find out. And, I mean, obviously, that's hella witchcraft. That is what witches throughout all time have been doing. Plant medicine is science. And again, we can go back to White Feather Hunter, and when someone wants to debase our knowledge, we can say, hypotheses are prophecies. Methodology is ritual. And again, that's that place where we build that bridge that you're talking about. These, we're talking about exactly the same things, but one has been demeaned and one has been elevated. And I do want to sort of put a note on the Virgo chapter, because, you know, Virgo, we have this need to organize and control to a large degree.
It's so delightful. And that's
it is. And this is, again, where we find our ritual is trying to take the chaos of the universe and organize it into a way that we can understand. But I brought two witches to that circle, Maijin Gonzalez Whipler and Genesis P. Orridge, because they were so different and so the same. You know, I say in the chapter so many times, like, I keep Maijin in one pocket and Genesis in another pocket, because Maijin has PhDs at the Wazoo. She was initiated in Santeria and credits the Orisha with all of the good things that have happened in her life. But she also has, you know, spoken and academic conferences and, you know, some Princeton and Harvard, and she is an academic. Her books are, here's the science behind what I'm saying, but also, like, here's some stuff about angels. Whereas Genesis, like, whip smart, hyper intelligent, tested off the charts when they were in school, but quit school as soon as they could. You're not going to tell me what magic is. You know, Genesis was like, I'm going to experiment wildly, and was also very well read, like, was a big fan of occultists of their time and reading a lot about them. But taking that, and instead of writing an academic paper about it, going into the streets and doing some kind of insane ritual that would make no sense to anyone on any kind of academic plane. So yeah, we witches, we are both of these things. And I even say in the chapter, like, I think if Maijin and Genesis sat down together, they wouldn't really have had a possibility of meeting in this realm. But if they sat down together, that they wouldn't try to tell each other that the other one's approach was wrong. Like, I think that they would sit down and laugh and say, look at these different paths that we took, and yet here we are arriving at this same place of the power of magic, and the power that we can conjure. Whichever way we do that, whether you want to go and get a PhD or you want to go and frolic in the lake, to me, these are like equal acts of magic and should be treated as such.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add, like, we've been through a period of anti-science culturally.
Yeah.
And so, we are really explicitly not anti-science. And it goes back to that, like, smugness of a lot of new age spaces, where you can get into this circle where, like, you and your people know the truth. And that has been used to harm us. Like, that has been used to damage women in particular, like, multi-level marketing schemes specifically targeted women who needed to make more money, a little bit more money, to fucking keep their family afloat. And that logic was used to convince us, to separate us, to say that we know better. We know better than science. We know better than mainstream media. Like, they took all of that language that was true to our activist core, and they used it against us, and they used it to divide. It has been used to divide and to manipulate people and to keep us uneducated and unhealthy. So I that goes back into that lemniscatory space, right? For me, into that Mobius strip is like, yeah, science has been held on high and witches' knowledge has been demeaned, but the opposite has also been true depending on what circle you're in.
Yes.
And so follow that loop all the way and stay curious, you know, stay curious, ask questions, do research, love research. Like, witches are seekers, but we're also skeptics. And we love the sciences, you know, we want to know what animal cognition theorists are doing, you know, or we want to know what the biology is of making our water safe. We're part of those systems too. So I just wanted to send that loving call out to the witches who love science.
I'm so glad you did. And I was thinking, like, the image that was coming to me, because I feel like I've had experience with that, you know, and all it takes really, I think, is some experiences that cannot be explained by science. And then coupled that with, like, in my case, you know, chronic pain that Western medicine just absolutely couldn't help me with and would flat out dismiss, that it was all in my head. And it can really push you over to the other side, right? Of like, you don't, yeah, no, I'm over here. I know what's really going on. And you know, like, this much. And the antidote to me, what I saw as you were talking, is we're just gonna bring it right back around, is dirt. Just getting my feet on the fucking ground, just dirt, like, literally presencing myself bare feet outside here now. And I think for some reason that that brings me back into holding that capacities.
Yeah, well, and dirt is so much more than a metaphor, right? Like in the United States and in Canada, the vast majority of our arable farming land has been made addicted to nitrogen through the overuse of fertilizer. And so that teaches the plants that instead of building complex relationships with the bacteria, fungi, insects that live in there to get their nitrogen from those things breaking down and from a diversity of plant life, that they should only get it from this really like intense hit of nitrogen that we get when we give it fertilizer. And so it teaches the land not to be in communion, but to be an addict. And so we're literally standing on land that is in withdrawal. And so I think about Sophie Strand saying, how can I make of myself good soil, right? This is someone whose chronic illness is first and foremost in their mind. She knows that she writes in an encounter with death, right? And so she says, how can I be a medicine? Why? How can I get out of this like addict thinking of I need one more heroic hit and then I will be cured? Well, maybe I can't be cured and maybe I'm not the most important. How do I become a medicine in the land that I'm on, in the communities that I'm on, right? And so the soil is not, getting our feet and our hands in the soil is not, it is a metaphor, and it's a metaphor where it's not a simile. It's not that soil is like our sickness and our healing. It's soil is our sickness and our healing.
Wow. Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you for saying that. Yes. Wow. I don't want to end this. We need to end this. We've been talking a long time. I have to let you guys go. You have to go do other things.
Somebody has to stop us, or we will just excitedly yell, the three of us, at each other. In love for days.
I don't want it to stop. Okay, we're gonna stop for now. Thank you so much for being here. I love you. I love your hearts and your presence and all that you're doing. So,
you know,
I'm getting a little weepy. Much gratitude to you.
We love you so much. We love you and your community so much.
Thank you. Their book, New Moon Magic. If you're actually watching, I'm holding it up. It's so pretty. I won't have that little thing on it. 13 Anti-Capitalist Tools for Resistance and Reenchantment. I wish you so much success with it. I don't know, maybe you'll come back again. Who knows?
Again and again and again.
And again and again. Yes. And thanks to all of you for listening, as always. I know I say this a lot now, so you must be tired of me saying this. Whatever, I'm going to say it again. I really would do this without you because these conversations are so fulfilling to me, but I am glad there's somebody else listening because that gives me a stronger excuse to do them. And if you like the show, you can leave it a 5-star review. You can subscribe. You can tell your friends about it. You can do all those things. And until next time, I hope you take very good care of yourself. And I'll talk to you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com. where you can find show notes and other episodes, you can read articles about the Sacred Feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.